All of us are on a journey of becoming, a never-ending journey in pursuit of truth and deeper union with the divine. As you know, faith is a complicated thing, and this journey of becoming can be both difficult and painful. Far too often, we have not been given a space where we can safely address the complications and issues that arise naturally. My name is Joshua Patterson, and I am also on this journey of becoming. I am dedicated to inviting you into my story and creating a space where questions and critical thinking are welcome. I want to take an honest look at the issues and questions so common to this shared journey. I want to genuinely seek out what it means to follow Jesus in our ever-changing world, in our unfolding and expanding universe, and in our pluralistic society. I have come to know that doubt is not the enemy of faith, but rather that both doubt and curiosity are two of faith's biggest allies. I have learned that the Christian faith is more about wisdom and love than it is about correct doctrine or belief. And I believe that we are being invited to continually seek out both wisdom and love, renewing our minds, expanding our hearts, and rethinking our faith in the process. Thank you for joining me on that journey. All right, friends, welcome to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and please join me in welcoming back to the podcast for their second time, Dr. Jonathan Foster. Jonathan, how's it going?
I'm doing good, man. Thank you. It's really good to be back. You're brave to have me on, not once, but twice. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's been a little while now, right? Since you were on the last time.
I've just been sitting around waiting for Josh to call me on the phone. When is it going to happen? So now, yeah, probably. Did we talk about theology of consent? Probably a year or so ago. So
yeah, that was, listeners can actually go back and find that in the, you know, in the archives, so to speak. That was a fun conversation.
Yeah, it was. It was good. So it's cool to be with you again. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Like I was telling you before we started, out of nowhere today, I just kind of started feeling not great. So, but I really enjoyed your book, and so I didn't want to, push off this interview and postpone it. So hopefully I don't come off as sick or something. But if I do, listeners, bear with me. I'm only human after all, you know. So, but yeah, so you have a new book out called Indigo, The Color of Grief. Or actually, I guess it's not technically out yet, right?
Well, I don't know when this will drop. So we did a crowdfunder that went really well, and that was a cool way to get going. And then now it'll be live December 5 on the Amazons and everywhere else. So if this goes before, people can pre-order it. If it goes after, just, you know, like normal. So yeah, it's good to go.
Good deal. Well, that's exciting. I'm excited for it to exist in the world. Obviously, I've had the privilege of reading it beforehand, and I really enjoyed it. It was cool to kind of see, because it's such a different kind of book than the first book of yours that I read, which was again Theology of Consent, and it was really cool. It has more of like a poetry vibe to it, which I was digging. So yeah, it was fun. I think, too, I was telling you prior to we started recording, when I was kind of looking through it before, I skimmed over it a couple times on like the digital PDF copy it sent me. But then I was like, I kind of want to just experience this thing all at once. And so I printed it out and then sat down and read the whole thing all in one sitting, which didn't take too long. But I'm glad I did, because I felt like you were creating not just a book, but an experience and inviting people into it. So I thought that was a cool way to engage it.
I'm glad you did that. I've heard that from multiples of the kind of pre-reading people who wound up just reading it in one sitting. And partly you can do that because it's not super long. I mean, it's only 12,000 words. The way I formatted it in the kind of poetry style. You know, it's 160 some pages, but I leave all this white space on purpose to try to give people room, you know, metaphorically, I suppose, symbolically, room to process their stuff as I'm trying to process mine. So I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And yeah, that's kind of cool.
It was also kind of interesting too, on it too, about an experience that I had while reading it. So I printed it out and I just did, like, you know, double-sided front and back. And I didn't have a kind of stapler that was, like, strong enough to, you know, staple the whole thing. So I kind of just picked it up and looked for, you know, where there was, like, a chapter break, and ended up stapling in three different places. But I found when reading, those three places kind of worked very well. It was interesting. So my first section that I read was from absence to this one. Come on. I should have wrote this down beforehand. To late. So absence to late was kind of like
that's
the first.
That's a good. Yeah, it's kind of a good first section.
Yeah. As kind of a movement. And then from interpretation to, let's see. Where'd it go? Yeah, and this is bad podcasting. I should have wrote this down. interpretation to anyone. Which was kind of a cool break. And then from strange, you know, through onto the end of the book. So it was completely random, but it felt like three kind of important movements within the book itself. So I thought that was, I don't know, weird or spooky.
I should have gotten your input before I put this together, man. I could have done, I like that. Three movements in the one, and oh, well, I'll get them. I'll get the next one. I'm already working on the, it's not really a sequel, but it's the second. I think I've got three books like this that are kind of similar. So maybe I'll work it in there.
Yeah, well, I'm curious. I mean, you share your, you know, your story and kind of where the grief that you explore comes from, but why now? What was it about, I don't know, maybe your current life situation or this specific moment in time, but why did you feel like telling your story of grief now made the most sense?
Yeah, that's interesting. So in some ways I've kind of been telling it all the way through, you know, like if you had been a part of, you know, my church, for example, when I was a pastor, when this all went down, when my daughter died on New Year's Day 2015, you know, for those first couple of years, it's not that I necessarily said her name every week, but I mean, basically it was in real time. People could tell I was trying to process this, and I wrote about it some then and in a kind of a handful of different ways. So in one way, I've kind of been writing about it. In another way, not to this depth and in this way. And I think what happened was that whole thing served to be an event that catalyzed me into this whole new stratosphere of thinking and rethinking my faith. Speaking of your podcast, I'll see how many times I can work in your podcast name through the.
I appreciate it. It's like an extra $5 every time. So sneak them in there.
Okay. it just kind of set me into this whole new thing. And, for the past 8.5, now almost 9 years, I've just been kind of wrestling with it or playing with it. The grief, the pain piece of it, but also what I think that it means theologically and what I think it might say about God and about humanity and about beauty and loss and life and all of these things. And so I suspect what happened is, you know, I've written several other books, so I had to kind of get that out of my system. And I did the dissertation, Theology of Consent, which was kind of these huge concepts that I was trying to play with. And after that all got done, which was a lot of work for me, I'm not by nature like an academic person. I mean, we would have all laughed if you'd have known me 20 years ago. This was not on the plan. But I think I had to try to get it kind of straight in my head as much as one can with theology. And then it's like I got all those words out. The dissertation is like 80,000 words, which is fairly normal, but I mean, it's a lot of words for me. And then after that, in the wake of all that, kind of in the quietness of all that, I was feeling like, oh, I need to process this grief some more with less words. How much can I say in with as few words as possible to try to convey the meaning? So I don't know if that's a great answer to the question, but it feels like something like that happened, like the dissertation and all that other stuff, all the sermons and the books and the blogs, and the dissertation served as the thing that kind of just thrashed everything out of the way. And in the wake of all that, I was able to write Indigo. And I guess I'm really thankful for that.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's interesting. It's, so for me, like, we all have experienced grief, I guess, to similar, you know, within our lives, and not necessarily, you know, for example, for me, I've experienced loss of like a grandparent, but I haven't experienced the kind of loss that you have, for example. And so my grief, the kind of things that for me that I grieve kind of look different. Like when I was reading through Indigo, the kind of thing that kept coming up in me was kind of a grieving of like an unprocessed grief or perception of loss of kind of my church experience and maybe what could have been with that kind of thing. And so for me, when I think about that, my way of kind of handling grief is either suppress it, which is not helpful, or I go like super heady. And so I feel like my thing would be like, okay, I have to figure out like some kind of theological framework that makes sense of this, da 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 da. And that would kind of be like this in some way processing, but also at the same time it would be me pushing it away so I didn't have to feel it. And then maybe eventually I would be able to kind of like settle down a little bit and be like, okay, I kind of like maybe now, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know. I find that interesting. I don't know. I had something else I would say, but I want to see if you had any thoughts there.
Yeah, that's obviously everyone's going to process it differently. I'm really glad you said what you said there at the beginning. It reminds me that, yeah, people should not hesitate to read the book. Like if you're someone who hasn't lost a kid or maybe something that feels that intense, it's for all of us. And I've noticed that there's, and I get it. I totally get it. That there's this little bit for some folks like, oh, I can't quite relate to that, or that's so hard, I won't be able to really understand. But all of us have experienced loss, whether it's, you know, loss of a relationship, of a loved one, or of time. You know, time itself passes by, and that's a loss. And then you just named the church thing. Like so many people in all of our, in both of our circles, are experiencing this whole loss of, like, what did that even mean, and what could it have been, and what could this world be, and what could church be, and who could I have been as a pastor or as a leader or whatever. And so when something gets ripped away from you like this, yeah, it really invites you to think about your identity and who you are. And, you know, as we both know, everything's relational, and our identity is created out of relationships. And when that thing is removed from your life, it's super, super challenging. So, and then the other thing I'll just comment on is, yeah, for sure, like we all, and I think maybe those of us who are more masculine programmed than feminine too, like do a really good job or a really bad job, as it were, of suppressing and trying not to, you know, deal with it too much, because it's just not a part of the script of masculinity in our culture, which is basically we have to win and dominate and constantly, you know, metabolize all this stuff quickly so that we can get on to the next thing and make sure that the ledger is always, you know, going up and to the right. And it's a really hard, I mean, it's one of the, there's multiple things that are super awkward and difficult about grieving. One of them for me has been constantly being reminded that in some ways I'm kind of like, this might sound too intense, and I don't mean it to be about my self-esteem, necessarily, but in some ways I'm kind of like a loser. I mean, I'm just lost, and I've lost a ton of things in my life. My daughter's most intense, but there's been a bunch of other things that have just absolutely broken my heart. So to constantly be in that position where you feel like, oh man, it's just, yeah, it's a vulnerability thing, and it's a power thing. And I don't mean to suggest that females don't deal with that, because I know that they do as well. But I do think that men, especially American males, especially Caucasian straight American males, maybe relatively affluent. I say relative because I don't feel affluent, but I know compared to my Haitian friends, I am. So, yeah, I think we struggle with all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think so. There's, and I mean, I guess that's too, where like when people talk about something like patriarchy, and they name how patriarchy obviously is harmful to women, but also it can be harmful to men as well.
Right, exactly.
Because it sets this kind of false standard for what it means to be a man or manly, or, you know, something like that.
I think that's so true. I was having a conversation with a author friend of mine who's written something about James Baldwin. And as we were talking, I was reminded about how much Baldwin helped me probably 5-6 years ago, when I was, among other things, this particular loss, as I already mentioned, you know, kind of catalyzed my changing and rethinking of my theology. And so as I was in the middle of that, I was trying to wrap my head around human sexuality and what the Bible has to say and who God is and all these things. And reading James Baldwin in the middle of all that really helped me in an indirect way, although maybe it's direct because he was a gay man. But he would say something, like I'm paraphrasing, but he would say something about Black-white relationships in America, like, it's not just that white people need to treat Black people better. That's not just, it's not good just for the Black person. It's good for the white person. It's good for humanity. And I remember reading that. I don't know if it was right in that second or during that week or whatever, and a whole bunch of other things happening, thinking, oh my Lord, this is the same thing with straight people and gay people. Like, it's not just good for the people who fall outside of the normalized whatever sexual expression. It's not just good for them. It's good for me. It's good for humanity. So yeah, I'm just saying what you already said, which is, yeah, it's good for others and good for myself. So to wrestle with that vulnerability and to admit it and to sit there is super, super hard, but I think it's good for everybody involved.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in a real way too, you are inviting people into kind of breaking that kind of cycle with Indigo, because you were willing to go vulnerable, right, into the tricky, painful, you know, parts of yourself, and kind of put them on display and invite people into your story, which I think, you know, for me, story is just so powerful, and listeners are probably tired of hearing me say it, but I think when in life there is this invitation to go deep enough into one's own story where others can see themselves there, and recognize, you know, themselves and know that they're not alone or something like that. And so kind of inviting, you know, people into your story in a way that is vulnerable, I think fights against kind of the, you know, patriarchal standards that are kind of put up and put forth.
Yeah, I think in some ways, it's funny, just I haven't thought about it until hearing you say some things like that. But I think in some ways, it's a defiant move for me. It's a move of like, no, this is what I think a healthy human can do and could do. And so I'm trying to do that. And I'm trying to bring people along with me, and not just take the standard tried and true route of ignoring it and speaking only about power and trying to pretend that, you know, I haven't experienced this gap, this huge absence, this loss in my life. So it's a really awkward, weird thing. And like, I don't like it, but also strangely kind of like honored. And all of a sudden I found myself here. And, you know, I write, that's the thing I do, I think, better than anything else. And so I've just, yeah, just decided I would lean into it and try to go as deep as I possibly, well, I didn't try. I mean, I didn't kind of really didn't have a choice. I was already drugged down so deep. So while I was there, try to make sense for me and hopefully for other people. Yeah.
You know, I think you accomplished that goal. And I mean, I, even something like, so there was a part in your writing that kind of made me chuckle. But it also, again, it was kind of this like realness, like in the kind of in this face of grief and stuff, and just the kind of silly things that people do. There's a bit where you end up like, I forget the word that you're, maybe spectrometer, but you're like, oh, that fucking spectrometer. And you're like, oh, you know, for whoever's listening, sorry for saying fuck. And like, yeah, that, I chuckled at that, but that is such like a human kind of moment and response where like there you're experiencing something that's so deep and raw. And then at the same time, you know, you act out of that and then you're like, oh, wait a minute, am I allowed to say that kind of thing? Like that moment in the book, I think brings the humanness to it. It's where I know that it's not just like a bullshit book for you. Cause it, I think it would be, it's, you know, there's so many books out there, I'm sure, that people have written that are very academic about grief. And it's like, here's your brain, this is what's happening, blah, 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 these drugs can help you. But I think what I love about your book about grief is how it just invites someone into an experience. And like, I guess the closest thing for like real deep grief that I've experienced is I had like a pretty strong bout of depression. Mm-hmm. And so like some of the kind of absence language and the no thingness language that you use, like I found myself in that, like it was a mm-hmm. real, just a being seen kind of thing, which I think sometimes can have more power than just the, here's the 10 neurotransmitters in your brain that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally, totally. It's back to that story thing that you're talking about, when we can enter into the story of, with someone else, we, you know, we experience it ourselves. And I have had a growing number of people, of course, at this point, not a ton of people have read it, but that's been a growing response of like the really interesting way. And I didn't plan on this. I'm not really that smart, but it seems to have developed in a way where it's equal parts really raw, and this is the story, and really bad, and like this is awful, but also, oh, it might be hopeful, but not in a Christian-y kind of like God's coming to fill the gap and everything's going to be complete and perfect way. So I'm really thankful. I didn't set out necessarily to do that directly. I'm thankful that worked out that way. And it's, I have to laugh hearing you talk about the F word, because I'm not a very good, I don't cuss very well. I'm just, you know, just, I don't, I'm not as good as you are at that.
I've had a little bit too much practice.
No, lots of my friends, it, you know, it can be, yeah. So to write that and to actually put it in print, which would just scare a lot of people, a lot of my friends probably. But it's what I felt, and it's what was going on. So it seemed to be the only thing appropriate to say at the time.
Yeah. I think language when used properly, cause I mean, yeah, is powerful. And if that's the word that fits best in that moment, I think it within your text, it does convey that sense of power. And I mean, I remember I had a hermeneutics professor tell me one time, like, hey, like, don't underestimate the, or not hermeneutics, sorry. Dang it. Sermon writing. Whatever that's called. There's a big word for it.
There's a word for it. Yeah. Homiletics or something.
Homiletics. There we go. There we nailed go. It. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Homiletics professor, tell me, like, never to underestimate the power of a strategically placed F word.
Yes.
In a sermon. And so I thought that was interesting. But yeah, I'm trying to, I'm trying to see, because my mind wants to jump around, and I have
go for it, man. Just jump
in front
around.
Of me. Yeah, there's so one of the points when you're talking about hope, like hopefulness, but not in a way that was, you know, like too Christianese or something like that. I think a big example of that for me was when you make theological claims or statements within the text, it's very invitational language, like perhaps it's like this, or maybe it's like that,
I suspect,
or you I mean, your section on beauty, I absolutely loved that. That was wonderful. But there was this point when you talked about being being flattened and like completely flattened, and you kind of have this realization of like, well, wait a minute, what am I being flattened against? Like, there's something there. And for me, that's hopeful without doing the like, oh, like everything happens for a reason kind of thing.
Right.
Like that's an example of that really stood out to me.
Cool. I'm glad for that. And yeah. That was really important to me. And it has been a growing awareness on my part over the last, again, 8-9 years of just growing more and more comfortable with not having to be certain about how to name this and what to name it, and to try to keep it really open so that the reader doesn't feel pressured to name it a particular way. Now, some of, you know, our more Christian-y friends are going to be frustrated by that, but you know, it may not be for them. It's really for the person who has the courage to let this massive, massive thing that frankly no one can ever really get to the bottom of. I mean, if we could answer, you know, all the problems with theodicy, then, you know, we would be, well, I started to say we'd be God, but I'm not even sure God can answer all the problems with theodicy. I think he or she is in the midst of it with us trying to figure it out. So I don't know what I was saying, but it'll come back to me at some point. But anyhow, so that was important, not to try to be too definitive about it. And also that wasn't, the other thing I'll say is that wasn't fake. Like if I'd have written it 5 or 10 years ago that way, it might've been, not fake's too strong a word, but it might've been slightly misleading, because I might've been like, oh, I'm just going to do this because I want to be nice. But I really know that what I really, you know is that God is actually, you know, going to fix it all perfectly in the end. And now it's more like, it's just a risk, man. Love is a risk. If risk isn't involved, I don't know what the hell it is. I mean, honestly, it's just not love unless vulnerability is a part of the thing. So I'm trying to be honest about that, but also be honest about what I think that I think, which is that love is patient and love is endlessly creative. And so I'm trying to hold on to the tension of all that.
Yeah, you have a really beautiful bit where you're talking about love that was deeply moving to me, and I'm going to jack up your words. So this is Jonathan Foster translated by Josh Patterson.
It'll probably be better. But, that's fine.
But you did this bit where you talked about that you think with great love kind of comes great suffering, and that perhaps we should pity, I don't know if this is the right word, but pity those who don't experience great suffering, because perhaps it's that they haven't had the privilege of experiencing great love. Mm-hmm. And like, that was kind of a moment where I, you know, stopped reading for a little bit and rolled that one over in my head a few times. And actually I thought about that for a good majority of my way home yesterday when I was driving home from work, you know, my hour commute. So that bit on love and suffering, commute, I think, is huge.
The commute made you feel like you were suffering?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's actually, this is 100% what I did. When I got in my car, I was like, I want to just sit with this and like sit in the kind of emotion of it. And so I went onto my phone like I'm doing now, and I looked up, what did I type in? I think I might have just searched grieving. And then Spotify generated a playlist called Coping for Loss, like made for Josh Patterson. And I just listened to that on the way home.
Wow.
While kind of sitting in the space and pondering. And some really interesting things happened for myself in that space. So, yeah, it was like, seriously, cool. I've thought about that a lot.
That's really cool. I wonder, it seems like you're probably talking about the part where I was walking with my oldest boy up the steps and he turned around and says too hard. So I go into a bit about that and end by saying what I think is, it's probably like one of the best 5 or 7 things I've ever said anywhere. And yeah, I told him that maybe the reason this hurts so much is because there's so much love there. And in that way, we can be thankful, because without that love, you know, this hurt is just evidence of the love. So that was really, really powerful for me, really important for me, because it, in my heart and mind, and that little story happened. It either happened the night our daughter and his sister died, or it was the night after, I can't remember, but it was very early on. And it was something that I'll never forget for lots of different reasons, not the least of which is how much how much pain I felt for my son, who had just lost, you know, his best friend. But also, yeah, something about the love and the suffer, the pain all wrapped up together. It's like symbiotic. It's like, it's two sides of the same coin. Pain and beauty are not mutually exclusive. And I've basically been trying to unwind what that means, you know, this whole time. There's something really, really great about that, but also incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for me, one of the reasons I turned to kind of open and relational thinking was wrestling with things like pain and suffering. Right. And not even necessarily my own. I mean, I had like a very shitty understanding of the divine, and that was difficult for me. But at first, I found myself trying to explain away suffering and pain via, you know, in the mode of open and relational thought. And it wasn't until much later, and even, dare I say, more recently, where I've started to kind of play with this kind of relationship that you're talking about. And then that makes me curious too, if, you know, when we're talking about the divine and we say something like God is love, what does that entail for something like the impassibility of the divine, which, you know, Hartshorne just says is a theological mistake, but
right.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to disagree with Hartshorne. So I think impassibility is highly problematic. And there's something for me and Tom Ord, obviously our mutual friend, we've had brief conversations about this, and I don't know that he totally agrees with what I'm about to try to say. I still don't have it all figured out. So, you know, if the listener has a choice to, you know, go with me or Tom, they should definitely go with Tom. But there's something about love for me that has just been wounded, and that is wounded, and it comes to us in a wounded, kind of fractured, broken way. And when I say that, I don't mean that it's necessarily weak, although it is a type of weakness, but it's a weakness that becomes a strength, which I think really aligns well with open relational thinking. And there's something about that gap and that absence piece of it. You know, I start the book by talking about, and it's really the main concept that really probably, and this maybe answers your very first question you asked, now that I think of it, it's the thing that probably motivated me to write more than anything else, which was this fascination I was having with the absence of my daughter, literally not there was creating a presence. It was the presence of the absence. So there was no form there, but it was forming me, you know, literally no energy. Relationships gone, but it was energizing me, which, side note, was really fascinating for people who might be listening, who are interested in, they should read Richard Boothby, who has a book called Embracing the Void, and also has a book called Blown Away, which is about his son's suicide. And Rick and I have become friends now, which is a really cool thing. It's one of the best things about writing for me is getting to meet people like you and others. And so he and I have gotten to know each other over the last year, and we don't say the same thing, but we're really harmonizing along this idea of the absence piece. So anyhow, sorry, I'm rambling. I just wanted to comment about when we say God is love, you know, love to me now, I've had to rehabilitate that word. I didn't want to get rid of it. Some of our theological words, I'm probably fine with getting rid of, but I didn't, there's just no way, it was no way I could get rid of love. So I've had to do all this work. So now when I say love, you know, I typically think non-binary, non-violent, non-scapegoating, intentional energy in relationship with God and others. But then I also add this, there's this absence piece of it. And I think the last thing I'll just say on this, because I could probably talk too long, but when I think of the absence piece, I think that's really embodied in the life of Jesus as he interacts with others who are different from him and bring a type of absence that he has to kind of engage with, because they all have these different problems that I might loosely define as absence, but it's really embodied on the cross when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's something really, really holy and awkward and weird about all of that. And so maybe if Jesus is the Son of God, that's evidence that there's a bit of antagonism and absence in God herself. And I think what I think is that God is love. So all that to say, yes, love is problematic.
No, I love it. I'm glad you came to the Jesus image. Because for me, when, you know, on days when I have a high Christology, I like to say cool things like Jesus is the image of the invisible God, or Jesus is the ultimate revelation of who God is. And so when I think about that in line with saying something like God is love, and then I think about the crucifixion and supposed resurrection of Jesus, at least within the stories, when Jesus comes back, when Jesus is resurrected, he still has his wounds. Yeah. They're not gone. Right. And he invites people into them, like, yeah, right, dude, check it out, kind of right thing. And so I think that love as wounded, and that kind of vulnerability, I don't know if I could give you a good, like, theological statement about it right now, but I think you're onto something. All that to say, I think you're onto something there. And also,
well, obviously, I was going to say, obviously, I can't give you a good theological statement either. And I just tried to write about it, and I still can't. So join the club.
Yeah, well, maybe there's something fun about that. There's an honesty in it. Something to play with, right? To go back to the idea of not clinging to certainty. And it ties into how you talked about beauty. Mm. Because for me, like, go put everything back that I just said about Jesus and the resurrection and the wounds and all this stuff. I don't know if that's true, but it's so beautiful that I really hope it is, and it ought to be true because of how beautiful it is. And sometimes, I don't remember exactly how you said it, but you said something about beauty being more true than truth. There's something like that.
I said I decided after at this stage, I suspect that beauty is truth more than truth is truth.
That's good. And also, as you were speaking about, like, the absence piece, and, you know, having that loss and like literally the physical absence of a loved one, it kind of also fast forwarded me a little bit in your book, where I don't remember if a friend is telling you this or if you are kind of saying it yourself, but there was a part where you talk about how people that we have lost kind of exist if they were a process, right? You sort of get some processy language, and we are too, then their existence impacted our own existence as a yeah. process, and they continue to kind of live on within us, within our own process, right? Which is cool, because the nerd theology side of me was like, oh cool, this is like objective immortality but with people right. to an extent, right? So that I don't know, I thought that was kind of a cool and beautiful moment as well.
Yeah, me too. And I loved how, yeah, theologically I can tell why you would like that and why we would both like that. It's a very process, open and relational thing. I allude to it a couple of times, but I definitely go a little bit deeper towards the end of the book when I'm talking about how interconnected everything is and enmeshed and entangled. And it's all a nested system, you know, overlap, like the baby inside the mom and the mom inside the baby. So, you know, at a cellular level, they're literally physiologically connected. And it's in part why moms, and I think this is true of dads too, but it's clearly it's a little bit different physiologically. But I think it's in part, well, I guess what I was going to say was that it's when you hear moms years later say, I still feel like my kid is with me. Like in some ways, they actually, at a cellular level, they might be still with them. And vice versa. So they're sharing that. So they're affecting each other. And all of us, it's kind of like all of us are inside the womb. I think is that we're inside the womb of God, but if it's not God, it's inside the womb of something. And we're all interconnected, sharing these psychosocial, cellular, atomic, you know, microbiological, cosmological, from the micro to the macro. It's so entangled, it's ridiculous. And all of that, like I said, I think might be God. And if there's a God, then maybe it's possible that we are all blending in with her, and then she's creating something new, and we're all living this life that goes beyond us. And maybe that's a part of what heaven is. I don't know. And if it's not, but we could still affect the way the future goes. And it's crazy because my daughter's not been around for almost 9 years, but the amount of the impact that loss has had on my life, the incredible amount of growth that has happened, not only just with me psychologically and spiritually and emotionally, neurologically, but then with loved ones and friends. And then, you know, things obviously like Haiti, she was planning to go to Haiti to be a medical missionary, and that got us going down there. All the relationships, all the things we've done there. So it's really quite amazing to think about how much the absence of something can create something new. And somehow she lives in all that in some way, shape, or form. And you don't even have to be believe in God to see how, oh, that's pretty cool and interesting. Of course, then if you don't believe in God, I can't imagine how it doesn't beg the question, well, how did that happen? Like, why is that happening? You know, that's more than just Darwinian survival of the fittest. Like, there's something really, really interesting going on with all of that.
Yeah. And to that point, and to an extent, if we take kind of all of that into consideration, the kind of impact felt, like, it's in a way you co-authored this book with
yes.
your daughter because of that. And yes. that's a really kind of cool and beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I love that language too, of the overlap. And you talked about the kind of nestedness of things. And kind of said, you know, maybe that overlap is God or something like that. And I liked that that bit it stood out to me. And also you mentioned Haiti, and in the book there's a bit where you talk about your experience kind of returning to Haiti and the soccer field bit and this kind of thing, and you use this image of like a window that you were sitting and you just like couldn't quite see out the window, but you could hear the kids like laughing and playing and this kind of thing, and kind of said like maybe heaven's like that. And I found that really beautiful and moving as well, because I mean, honestly, for me, heaven right now is more so a hope of less than a like, hey, I'm pretty sure this is what happens when I die. something that I hope is true. And so I don't know. I liked that window metaphor. And I also too like how you you know, the contrast of that. You talked about how kind of we can create heaven, and in the same way we create hell. And so that the heaven and hell bit was really creative. I enjoyed it.
Well, that's cool, man. Thank you. You know, a lot of that stems from the one little line from Jack Caputo, which is his idea that God doesn't exist, that God insists. Whether God exists is up to us. Will we align ourselves with the insistence? And it's crazy how one tiny little sentence, so much life can spring from that. So there's a lot of, and then also it's very congruent with Abraham Heschel, who says God's waiting to be disclosed. And so I think, you know, Heschel would say something like what we would want to say, which is that, you know, as God waits, that God might not be disclosed unless we pick up whatever the path, you know, pick up the invitation that love's laying down for us to, and then God can be disclosed in that. So I love all that. And then the Haiti story was super, again, it's one of those poignant, dramatic moments in my life that I will never, ever forget, sitting in that little clinic that my daughter had helped construct a couple years before we were there. And then we were back in that same spot. It's a very remote place. It's only about 80 miles from Port-au-Prince, but it takes like, depending on rain season and all that, it could be 7 to 9 hours. And it's just driving over, there's no roads. It's just riverbeds and sides of mountains and cliffs. And it's ridiculous. It's every time we've gone, unfortunately, we haven't been able to go in a couple of years because of the political unrest in Haiti right now. It's just not appropriate, to say the least, to take any people down. But every time I take a group down or go with my oldest son, who has taken lots of groups, although half of the trip, I'm like, why am I doing this? This is not safe. This is ridiculous. It's not roads. Anyhow, to be in that room and to hear the kids playing soccer, I could hear them, but I couldn't see through the window. It was the same spot my daughter had played soccer and had such a great experience. And so I was imagining her in that moment, and I kept hearing those sounds. And yes, then it made me think of heaven. Like, maybe heaven is the sound, you know, I say in the book, heaven is the sound of children laughing. But maybe it is just the sound that's coming through, that's then the rhythm against which, you know, we get to build lives and disclose God and lean into the insistence, you know, that the sound is an insistence. And as we do that, we co-partner, to use your language. And by the way, thank you for saying that. I don't know that I'd totally thought about that, but you're absolutely right. In many ways, my daughter did co-author this thing with me, which, holy cow, that's going to mess me up for a couple of days now. So thanks for that.
I'll cover your therapy bills. I apologize.
Okay. Well, I need to mention your podcast name about 200 more times. And I'll,
there you go.
Anyhow, yeah, the sound of all that and the co-authoring, and how much I really think I really think it's a beautiful vision of what God might be like, that God's like this good parent who doesn't want, who maybe even can't do all the work and doesn't want to do all the work, but really wants to see what we will do and to partner with us. And to be able to do that with the divine, what an amazing thing we all get to be called into doing and building heaven on earth, or like you said, or maybe building hell too, because I think if the one is true, the other is true. I don't think hell exists. I think it insists. And if you want to lean into that, you can do that too. And obviously a lot of people do. Unfortunately, I think the super religious person might do more than anyone.
Yeah, that language of God being disclosed for many of the reasons that you just listed is really powerful to me. And it, because I think of too, just in reading some Jewish thought around theodicy and stuff, kind of talking about this idea of like, oh, look at all this bad stuff that's happening. Like, what is this revealing about God? And this rabbi I was reading flipped it and said, well, like, no, it's what's it revealing about us? Right. How we are disclosing the divine. We're supposed to be image bearers and we're doing all this crazy shit. Like, we're, you know, we have a role to play. And I know, you know, some people can get uncomfortable with that because of the whole like works righteousness thing and da da da. But I think this idea of God being disclosed actually, and the co-partnering, the co-creator language, actually gives more responsibility and maybe a sense of call, to use Christian language or something like that, to humanity, to kind of give us something to live into, or not live into, right? Which we're pretty good at doing that as well.
Yeah, the word that comes to mind when you say that is esteeming. It esteems humanity. And so much of Americanized religion has not done that. It's done the opposite. It's done everything it can. It has been able to do to suppress us. And I do want to say, I think a lot of times people have done that for good. They've had good intentions when they've done that. And I totally get it. But now that we've arrived at this place and the evolution of who we are, we clearly have the ability now to be able to kind of look backwards and see, okay, we see where all of that depravity kind of thinking got us, and sinful thinking. And like in my own tradition, there wasn't a Sunday that went by that we weren't called to die out to ourselves and to completely do away with our own desires. What I realized years later, and this is where Girardi and mimetic theory stuff helped me, was oftentimes it was not what the preacher wanted, but oftentimes what the preacher was doing was setting us up to be adversaries of God. Like, we had to lay all of our stuff down and God had to win and we had to lose, and, you know, sacrifice and all those things. There's a measure of truth in there, but I think the dysfunctional Americanized Christian religious system, you know, really infected it. And so it's not particularly healthy. So what I hear you say is something, you know, the word that came to mind was estimation and agency. And I just think that, I don't think our world can hear enough of that. Like, so for listeners, especially young people, I really think that you can figure it out. I mean, you already kind of know what to do. You already have everything inside of you that you need. And God's always been with you. You've always been with God. It's like when Jesus told the story about the prodigal son, and the father's talking to the older brother, you know, at the end of the story, and he's like, look, man, you've always been with me. Everything I've ever had has been yours. And so for people listening, I think that might be the most powerful, one of the most powerful things that you can grab onto, is the fact that God's already with you, and you already know it, you're capable. And God esteems you, love esteems you, at least to use your language. That's what I want to think.
Yeah, I love that. And that's what I would like to think as well. Yeah. Especially when, you know, pragmatically, we see like how far our thoughts and prayers get us in various things in life. And that's, I think, probably all I need to be said about that. But speaking of like the pragmatic, I'm curious because you talked about in your book, and I have seen this play out because it drives me crazy. You kind of share examples of different kinds of times of tragedy and loss in your life where a well-meaning friend came along and said something like, everything happens for a reason, or God needed another angel, or something like that. For me, that language has always just never sat well with me. It was always abhorrent. But I have seen friends who have suffered extraordinary loss, like crazy loss. The loss of, you know, a friend who had quadruplets and only two of them made it. Mm-hmm. Or a friend recently from college who experienced essentially a failed pregnancy, a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And will use this language of, it's God's plan. God is, you know, blah, blah, blah. And for me, that never, like, it didn't work for me. That made me angry. And so I was just curious, like, in your own experience, did that kind of language, like, ever resonate with you? Or was that kind of always something that kind of bothered you? Like, what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, so in the book, I think I mentioned four or five of the things that we've all heard. People will say, well, I guess God needed another angel, or the other one is everything happens for a reason, or one of them that really did a number on me when I was younger was something along the lines of, well, God must have big plans for you. And when I was in my 20s and coming out of a very, a lot of really, really good stuff about the way I was raised, and all things considered, I don't have much to complain about. But religious wise, it was a lot of, you know, you were overcomers, victorious, and everything that happens for a reason that's make you stronger. And, you know, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I really bought into all that, and partly probably again, because of my masculinity, and also I'm pretty competitive by nature, and I'd like to win. And, you know, I just assumed I was, you know, everything was designed to make my life better in the long run. So that was one that tripped me up when I was younger. I kind of bought into that a little bit, like, oh yeah, okay. So now I'm really going to be really cool. I'm really going to be mega church pastor, and my church is really going to grow now, or, you know, back then I was writing songs. So like, yeah, I'm clearly going to have a number one song, and now it would be writing a book, you know? So I really had to work through all that, and all of that stuff, working through those things, was a combination of my theology being pulled apart and then kind of being put back together one by one. I realized that, you know, those things way too simplistic. Life's way more complicated than that. And also God is more complicated and interesting and intriguing than that. And not so boring as to do harm to certain people in order to make my life better or whatever. What an absolute joke that is. It's terrible, terrible theology. So to answer that part of your question, yeah, it's taken me a few years to work through that to where now I have the confidence to say, you know, that's BS, a lot of that stuff. However, what I also want to say is that, yes, to your point, I have a lot of friends that still seem to gain some confidence and some assurance and some comfort from those things. And I don't always understand it either, you know, because to me, to enter into that, there would have to be such cognitive dissonance to actually say God is love, but also that everything happens for a reason, because then God is what, literally pulling the levers and pushing the buttons and causing my kid to die? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. If God's powerful and good, you know, none of these things make any sense. But to your point, you know, we're just meaning-making creatures. And if we latch onto something to help us make meaning, and it can like assuage or assuage, I don't know how to pronounce the word, the fears for a while and dispel the darkness and the chaos and the absolute panic that can overtake us, which I absolutely believe is happening, you know, by gradations, various degrees to all the humans across the world. I mean, not everyone's going to deal with it as intensely as the next person. And not everyone is even as aware of what they're dealing with. But I actually really think that we have this dreaded existential sense of panic because we know down deep we can't control anything. And we're pretty sure God, like, it doesn't even make sense. God can't control it, because if he could, this world would not be where it's at. So we latch onto these things and it gives us comfort, and you know, it's okay. And so now, even in that part of the book, I tried, the first time I wrote it, I was probably much more snarky and critical, which I know a lot of people would have really liked. And honestly, I probably would have sold more books. But as I read back through it a few times, I backed off on all that because it didn't feel gracious. It didn't feel like I was bringing compassion into the thing. And so I didn't want to shoot myself in the foot, because I felt like the rest of the book, the rest of the writing was fairly compassionate and gracious. And, you know, having said that, I still have friends who think, you know, that it was a little bit scapegoaty and I went too far. Anyhow, I'm trying to answer your question. I find that very interesting too, how people can hold on to these very simple things. But when I can just back up and take a breath and say, it's okay, I don't have to bring my dissertation brain into this. It's what humans do. And it gives me a chance to just be patient with them. It's good for me and for them. Back to our earlier theme. Sorry, that was a long, rambling response.
No, it's good. I mean, it's a complicated question, but I mean, I love that kind of posture of stepping back and seeking compassion, because I know previous versions of Josh would want to do the, like, well, let me throw this theology at you kind of thing. And totally, in those moments of deep grief and pain, like, it probably doesn't really, like, it doesn't matter if people agree with me or not. Like, that's not what they need right now. And, you know, if this kind of theological idea that I find abhorrent is serving a positive purpose for them in that moment, maybe I should just let that alone for right now, and we can talk about that later. You know, but that's, and you kind of talk about that in your bit about friendship, which I loved, just the
solidarity over solutions.
Yeah, it was really big. And you know, those kind of friends that are willing to be like, go to hell with you, basically.
Right. Well, what's interesting about that is, even just the way you're asking, that makes me think. So I basically wrote that trying to encourage people, when you're connecting with someone who has been hurt this bad, they really don't want solutions. I mean, they do, but there aren't solutions. So really what you give them is solidarity, your friendship. And I think that that is a Jesus move. I think that's a move of love. But then now what I'm thinking of as we're talking about it is, that's true for me too, when I'm with the person, yes, who's doing what you're doing, who's coming up with this answer that I think is abhorrent. It probably doesn't serve their best interest for me to then theologize to them and then try to fix their theology in that moment. In that moment, then now I am compelled to follow my own advice, which is, oh man, just be in solidarity with them. So what that their theology sucks? I mean, what, like, your theology doesn't suck sometimes? It's, you know, so it's so true, and it works both ways. And that's why it's so challenging and hard. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think there's so much wisdom in presence, like just being with. And that was something that a professor of mine in college, like, really drilled in our heads, was just presence. And Like, I mean, I even remember having...
Is this your homiletics professor? Same guy?
different professor.
Oh, okay.
This was a youth ministry guy.
Okay.
Who experienced all sorts of crazy things in his many, many, many years of youth ministry. It's Stephen, one of my favorite professors that I had at Messiah. The presence bit, it just feels so important. And I remember even recently, I have a good friend, a couple, and his wife was diagnosed with breast cancer a couple years ago. And he would call and talk to me and be like, Josh, nothing that I'm saying to her is making her better. Like, what do I need to say to her? And I was like, dude, shut the fuck up. Like, that's what you need to do. Like, you don't need to say anything right now. Just be present. Like, you're not going to have the words. And that's okay. It's okay not to have words in those moments. And I think that's, something that I've learned kind of the hard way by trying to be a problem solver in those kind of moments and not being quiet and compassionate and present. And so I don't know. I really appreciated that you talk about that, because I think it's very practical and helpful to those experiencing grief, or those in engaging with people experiencing grief. So,
yeah. And maybe all of us all the time, like, you know, just shut up. And most of my interactions I'm having with my partner, we've been married 34 years and she doesn't need me to, you know, really fix it. And vice versa. We just are doing it in life. So I think to the degree that all of us can cultivate that ability just to be present with people, to be a non-anxious presence, to add a little counseling therapeutic language to it. To the degree that we can all do that, I think our world would be a much better place. Can you imagine Israel and, you know, Palestine, if they could just be present right now, how much our world would change. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm with you. And I think too, for people who are like me and they're listening right now and they're like, but like, I have to tell people what I think, kind of thing. I'll just say I had an experience recently where my wife has been going, asking some big existential questions, questions that, you know, I've started asking a little bit earlier because I'm weird and not a normal person, bit of a nerd. But I haven't been offering, I've just been kind of listening to her talk about it and hear her out and affirm her and the kind of questions she's asking. And yesterday, she asked me like if I had any thoughts on it. And so that was kind of a really cool thing, because I'd just been trying to be patient for like over a month now. And cool. she finally asked, like, well, what do you actually think? So I could share a little bit of my thoughts with her, and it was very well received. So I think patience is a virtue as well.
Well, it says somewhere that love is patience.
Weird.
Patience is love. So I think that's a good word, man. And that's encouraging. And when you started to just share that brief little story, like, that is so much of my wife and I, for whatever reason, I've always arrived at these theological things a little bit quicker. Some of it was because I had to, because I was a pastor and I was dealing with it. And so, yeah, that has played out multiple times. And I'm not great at it yet, but I've gotten better at just if she doesn't need it to, you know, be fixed right now, it's fine. And there'll be a moment when she asks, and others too. So hopefully we can all get good at that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think perhaps patience is a good way to kind of end our conversation today. And I have really enjoyed this, Jonathan. Thank you so much for
Thank you.
Thinking of me and sending me a copy of your book. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to be returning to it probably more than once, and I already have some people in mind that I would like to share it with once it's available.
Well, and now that I know you're a tactile guy, make sure you email me your physical address, and I'll send you an actual copy. But yeah, no, I appreciate it, man. It's a deep subject. You know, we can't exhaust it, but I'm really honored to have played a small part in writing about it, and hopefully it'll help a few people.
Yeah, well, I think it will. It's I liked it a lot. I was telling my grandmother about it over lunch today. So,
oh wow,
it's pretty cool. But
if you're recommending it to grandma, then we're doing good.
Yeah, right. good deal. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much. I'll be sure to link all of the things in the show notes. And
cool.
Yeah, listeners, thank you for hanging out today and stepping into this deep, messy conversation mm-hmm. with us. Mm-hmm. And as always, guys, go in peace.